So I'd like to start now, and today's lecture is going to be on adsorption. And I hope in the next six lectures that I'm going to be giving, you're going to get a sense of the diversity of problems that can be attacked by non-equilibrium statistical physics. I will be discussing a wide range of physical problems where the application of the master equation method and other tools of statistical mechanics are decisive at illustrating these problems. And so today I'm talking about the problem of irreversible and reversible adsorption. And this is truly an interesting problem. And let me give you a physical example to tell you how interesting it is. What is the most interesting thing you could ever see? Watching paint dry. Isn't that interesting, right? Paint drying is incredibly interesting. Why is it interesting? Because you know that if you paint a wall and you do it crappy, that the paint will crack very soon and the coverage won't be good. And so one has to be careful how you put the paint on the wall so that it dries properly. And in particular, latex paint has latex particles in it. And these latex particles, as the paint dries, sticks to a surface. And if the coverage of the latex particles is very complete, then you get a nice paint job. But if the coverage is very incomplete, you get a crappy paint job, and the paint will crack very soon, and you'll have to repaint. So the problem of adsorption kinetics arises just in the issue of paint drying, which, again, is one of the most interesting things you could ever watch. And there's a whole host of other problems, mostly in the framework of polymer kinetics, where adsorption plays an important role. Polymers adsorb onto surfaces of cells and do things. And a lot of biological processes are based on adsorption of molecules onto surfaces where something will happen once that occurs. Another such example is in the catalytic converter of a car, where there is carbon monoxide produced by the combustion. And if it adsorbs onto a surface, there are catalysts that converts it to CO2, which, even though CO2 is terrible now that we're learning, it's a lot less bad than CO. So the problem of adsorption kinetics appears in biological processes, technological processes. And what I want to do today is give you a sense of the richness of adsorption kinetics. So first, let's talk about the most trivial example, which is monomer adsorption. In a one-dimensional system. So what I have in mind here is I have a one-dimensional lattice, and there are these little adsorption sites, so these little cups are meant to represent adsorption sites. And we have a gas of monomers floating above this one-dimensional line. And these monomers come down, and if they hit an adsorption site, they stick there forever. And so this process is as dull as drying paint, because what happens, we can write down an equation for the time rate of change of the density. And how does the density change? It's proportional to the density of vacancies. So the density of vacancies is 1 minus rho. And in principle, I should put some rate constant here, but I'll just set it equal to 1 without any loss of generality, which means just redefining its time. So this is the rate equation for the time rate of change of the overall density. And the solution to this equation is just simply rho of t is equal to e, sorry, 1 minus e to the minus t. So the density goes to complete coverage eventually. And the rate at which you adsorb is proportional to the density of vacancies. And eventually, there's no vacancies left, and the process is over with. So this would be a complete paint job. So that's monomer adsorption in 1D. But in reality, in real physical applications, one has the adsorption of extended objects, which fill up more than one adsorption site. And once you get extended objects, you can get a situation where you have some object, say a dimer, something like this. Here is a dimer. And if this site is occupied and this site is occupied, then this dimer has no chance of absorbing here because there's no other place. One guy can come in, but the other guy is floating around in midair, and it won't stick there forever, and it'll just desorb. So when I have extended objects, then the adsorption process is no longer complete, and we can start asking questions, which is, what is the kinetics of the adsorption of extended objects on substrates? The simplest possible case to consider is the so-called dimer adsorption, in one dimension. And so let me begin with the punchline, which is a really beautiful result that was first derived by Paul Flory in about 1939, I think. He was a polymer chemist who won the Nobel Prize in chemistry, you know, maybe about 30 years ago. And when I was a graduate student, he was someone to be feared because he was so smart and he knew everything. And any problem that was out there that hadn't been solved yet, he would solve it. And so he came along in the late 30s and solved this dimer adsorption problem. And if you read his original paper, it's one of those things, you read it and it's a little bit depressing because he's obviously so smart and so good at combinatorics that, you know, how could I ever do what he did? And so his answer was that in the infinite time limit, the coverage of the lattice went to 1 minus e to the minus 2. So one interesting point is just the beauty of this answer, e to the minus 2. And if I look at this numerically, this is something like 0.864 dot, dot, dot. So there's not complete coverage, but it's pretty good coverage. And what I want to show in the next few minutes, though, is how to calculate this final coverage by the methods of statistical physics. So again, the idea here is that I have my one-dimensional lattice. And so here are my little cups that are adsorption sites. And so when a dimer comes like this, so a dimer is a rigid, I can think of it as a molecule that contains two atoms. And when it comes to two consecutive empty sites, it'll absorb irreversibly. But then if another dimer comes, for example, here, and attempts to adsorb on this site and that site, this attempt is rejected. And so the process that we're going to be studying is one in which you randomly pick two sites on the substrate. If they're both empty, you adsorb. And if they're not both empty, you reject it, and you just start over again. So this is the problem we want to study. Now, before I study the real problem, let me make some contact with things we've learned before. And let's just look. Oh, question. Okay. Well, so this is, I would just say, is how would I describe it? It's just that we're trying to account for how does the density change with time. And so I'd like to say that, you know, here is my system at time t, and here is my system at a later time, which has maybe more molecules already adsorbed. So here's t plus dt. And I'm just trying to ask, what is the change in rho per delta t? And so the change in rho is just how many vacant sites there are. And so delta rho will be equal to the density of vacant sites. And then I have to divide by dt. And so that's where this comes from. Thanks for the question.
Yes. So rho then is the density of
No, rho is the density of filled sites, correct.
Okay.
So before I solve this full dimer problem, let's just do elementary enumeration and just understand what happens for a very small system. So let's, as a preliminary, look at systems of size 2, 3, and so on down the road. And part of the reason for illustrating small systems is to show that there's a very important difference between equilibrium filling of the lattice and non-equilibrium filling. So for example, let me call J sub L. Let me define this to be the number of jammed configurations in a system of size L. So for example, if I have a lattice which contains only two sites, then how many jam configurations can I have? Only a single one. I can adsorb a dimer at these two points. And so I have clearly J1 is equal to 1. Let's look for, this is J2 equals 1. Let's look now for three sites. What can happen now for three sites? How can I adsorb a dimer on this? Well, there's two possibilities. I can either adsorb on the left two sites, leaving the right site vacant because I can't adsorb there. Or I could adsorb on the right two sites. This chalk really is dying. And that's it. So those are the only two possibilities. So I have J3 is equal to 2. Let's look at J4. So for J4, so I have four possible sites. So one possibility is that I absorbed here with my first dimer, but then later on, at some point, the second dimer is going to come in, and so I will fill the system completely. Another possibility is that I put my dimer in the middle two sites of my four-site chain, and the process ends. So here I have J4 is also equal to 2. And so you can now do the exercise of just counting the number of different states as they increase the size of the system. But as you may have a sense, in statistical physics, we're typically not interested in small n. We'd like to do it for general n. And there's a very simple recursion formula that these J sub L's satisfy. And so instead of doing it kind of tediously, straightforwardly, line by line, let me now just write down a recursion formula that JL satisfies. How can I build a jammed configuration from a lattice of L sites? And there's two ways you can do it. So here's a graphical picture. I could have a lattice, which is L minus two sites, which has some configuration, whatever it is. I don't care. And then on the last two sites, I add a dimer. So if I take a lattice of L minus two sites, which is a jammed configuration, so this is J L minus two, and I add a dimer at the left, I'll build a configuration, a jammed configuration of size L. But then there's one more possibility, which is I could have a lattice of size L minus three, whatever it is, and I could have put a dimer adjacent to it, and then the very last side of the lattice is empty. In doing this, I also generate a configuration, a jam configuration of size L, building it from a jam configuration of size L minus 3. So here I have JL minus 3. And so we have a recursion formula, which is just, let me maybe put over here, JL is equal to JL minus 2 plus JL minus 3. And hopefully, in the tutorial you did yesterday, you learned how to solve the Fibonacci sequence. And this is son of Fibonacci sequence. And so it's easy to calculate here that JL, asymptotically, as L goes to infinity, scales to some number, 1.342 dot, 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 to the power L. You had a question?
How come we don't multiply the L minus 3 recursion by 2 to represent filling on the putting the 2 on the right?
Well, you see, the way that I'm building this is I'm imagining that I start here on the left side, and I just want to right side, try and be less dyslexic. And I'm trying to now build up my lattice just adding to the left. And so I'm just, this is a proper way of then counting for every single configuration that contributes to JL. So I'm building from the right side and just sequentially building to the left. Well, no, the thing is that the L minus 2 comes from this one, where I fill up, you know, I have the system of size L minus 2 has a jam configuration, then I add one more dimer here. Whereas this one is a jam configuration of size L minus 3, I add a dimer in site L minus 2 and L minus 1, and site L is then forced to be empty. Okay. So anyways, here is what might be called the equilibrium problem of just enumerating all the possible jam configurations of a small system. And you know, I don't know what your taste is on this, but I find it fun sometimes to play these games and just enumerate and see what I can actually get out of the system. But let me now mention a very important feature about the small system enumeration, which is that this problem might be called the equilibrium problem, in the sense that every single jam configuration, I am counting with the same weight. I'm assuming that each of these configurations, I said that this counted one, they count with the same weight. And if we continue, but the point is that if I really do true non-equilibrium adsorption, these two configurations do not occur at the same weight in the non-equilibrium process. So let me show you what happens in the non-equilibrium process, because it's important to appreciate the distinction between equilibrium and non-equilibrium adsorption. So in the non-equilibrium process, I imagine that the process is going on as a function of time. So I start with an empty two-site lattice, and then it gets filled. So clearly, it's the same situation as here. And the way that we can distinguish the non-equilibrium and the equilibrium is let's count the average occupancy in the equilibrium situation and in the non-equilibrium situation. So equilibrium, the average occupancy is clearly 2. Let me try and make my columns here a little bit better defined. So here I had J3 was equal to 2. And I want to now have a column for the n average. So here it was 2. Here it's 2. Here, what is n average? So here is one configuration that has 4 sites on it. Here's a configuration that has 2 sites occupied on it. So n average is 3.
What is, I'm a little lost.
OK, ask a question.
What is n average?
N average is the number of particles that are on the system in the final jam configuration. So we start here with the two-site lattice full, so n average is 2. Here it's 2. Here, though, it's 3. But now let's look at the non-equilibrium situation. So in the non-equilibrium situation, I start with my lattice, which has 3 sites. And there are 2 places that the dimer can adsorb. It can adsorb over here, or it can adsorb on the right side. And then the process ends. There's no chance for additional adsorption. So for this particular case, n average is, again, just 2. Here it was 2. But something different happens when I go to this case. In this case, there are 3 possibilities for adsorbing on a chain of 4 sites. I could absorb here, I could absorb here, or I could absorb here, each with the same rate. So 2/3 of the time, I would adsorb at the end. I would absorb either at this end, or I'd adsorb at the right end. So say with probability 1/3, I have this. Or with the probability 1/3, I have adsorbing on the right end. Or with the probability 1/3, I would adsorb in the middle. So each of these occurs with the probability 1/3. But now, as I let the process go to completion, for this configuration or that configuration, there's yet one more place where a dimer can adsorb. And so at the end of the day, these 2 configurations will be completely occupied, whereas this guy, one dimer has effectively blocked out 2 dimers, and so we're done with this one. So if I now ask what is n average for this guy, n average, 2/3 of the time, I'm going to get a density of a number which is 4, and 1/3 of the time, I'm going to get a number which is 2, 10/3. Which is not 3. So this simple-minded example gives you a sense of how the beginnings of the difference between equilibrium enumeration of all jam configurations and the true non-equilibrium process. And it turns out that this difference is actually, it continues even as n goes to infinity. So even in the thermodynamic limit, there is a finite difference between the equilibrium number of jam configurations and the number of non-equilibrium jam configurations. So if I look at the final density coming back to here, let me just write, this is rho infinity non-equilibrium, whereas rho infinity equilibrium. And I'm not going to show this today, but let me just tell you what the number is. Turns out to be some weird number, 8.8229... So it's rather striking, because you might think that as n went to infinity, this little distinction really doesn't matter, but it really does matter. OK. Yes, question?
The average is like an ensemble average over many of the same systems.
Well, yes, exactly so. But what I'm doing here is I'm actually enumerating every single possible configuration and counting n for each configuration, then averaging over it. Similarly here, I'm computing every single possible configuration, but in a non-equilibrium ensemble where I imagine that there's a time ordering to the dimer adsorption. And so I'm just following it to the very end and asking at the very end of the process, when it can no longer adsorb anything, what is the final coverage of the system? And so when I do it equilibrium, and non-equilibrium, I find slightly different answers.
What happens for the aerial system in a port setting? Like, what's the physical dependence?
Well, again, the case here is that when I was just doing a purely like mathematical algorithm, just count the number of different ways of packing dimers on a four-site lattice. There's this way and there's that way, and they have the same probability because I'm counting every single configuration with the same weight. I'm doing, in the language of equilibrium statistical physics, I'm studying the microcanonical ensemble. Every single microstate happens with the same probability. But we saw that when I do this in a non-equilibrium situation, where I imagine just having a dimer float from above and somewhere land on this four-site chain, two-thirds of the time it'll land either at this point or at that point. One-third of the time it lands in the middle. And when it lands in the middle, the rest of the lattice is dead. And so I get a different coverage in this configuration, in this situation, than I did over here. The right-hand one is more physical from, well, I guess what I'd say is if I was doing purely irreversible adsorption, the right one is more physical. If I had equilibrium adsorption, where I had adsorption plus desorption, the system could go to equilibrium, this would be more appropriate. Okay, so what I want to do now is I want to derive this weird number, 1 minus e to the minus 2. And again, in your situation, you may not appreciate how difficult it was to derive it using the tools of equilibrium statistical physics. But basically, here you're getting a little bit of a taste of the numeration problem that one would have to solve to then compute this final coverage. But what I'm going to show now is using the right tools of non-equilibrium statistical physics, one can derive this in a very elementary and, I think, a very appealing way. So the crucial thing whenever you're dealing with non-equilibrium processes is to come up with the right elementary excitations, the right description of the process. And what I argue is that the right way of understanding the dynamics of the process is to find a quantity called E sub m as the empty interval probability. So let me define E sub m is defined as the probability of finding an empty interval. Empty interval of size, and now here comes the tricky part to this, of size greater than or equal to m. Normally, you think I define a quantity with an index m that refers to the number of intervals of size m. But here, it's this number of intervals of size greater than or equal to m. So what I mean by this pictorially is this should be thought of as the probability that I have a configuration that looks something like this. There are m sites where every single site in this consecutive m sites are empty. But then, outside of this, I don't care. This site could be occupied, it could be empty, I don't care. I'm not paying any attention to it. So this is a fundamental quantity from which we can derive the evolution of the coverage in a very simple way. So the way you should view this E sub m is that you're looking at your one-dimensional lattice and you have blinders on, and they're blinders of width m, and you look through and you say, here's my lattice, and here might be some configuration of occupied and empty, whatever it is. And you have your blinders, which are this wide. And you say, in this region, are all the sites empty? In this region, are they all empty? And I don't care about anything outside. So you should think of yourself as a horse who's wearing blinders, and you're just scanning through the lattice and counting the total number of intervals that you see that are all empty, and then dividing by the size of the system. That will give you E sub m. So with this information, what I want to do now is write a master equation for the evolution of E sub m. And again, I know that some of you might be boggled by the whole notion of master equations, but you're going to get bashed over the head in the next six lectures with many examples of the master equation approach. And I hope by the end of this, it'll start looking more and more comfortable. So let me now write down an equation for dE sub m by dt. How does this change? So again, we're thinking that we're a horse, and we're looking at with blinders of width m. And we see in front of us an interval which is a size m, which is empty. How many ways, how does it change with time? First point, yes?
It should only ever decrease, right?
Absolutely. You're anticipating my next sentence.
Sorry.
So perfect. No, it's perfect. So as Chris has just pointed out, E sub m can only decrease. There's no way you can create an empty interval because if an interval is already occupied with adsorption, you can't get rid of that what's there. So because of only adsorption, the only terms on the right-hand side have a minus sign. And so here are the two terms that contribute to the change in E sub m. M minus 1. Well, so I'm going to write down the equation, then I'll explain all the terms. So there's a term like this, minus 2 em plus 1. And so let's describe these things. And the way you can really understand this in a very simple way is now think about parking a car in a parking spot. And so here we're parking cars which are discrete length cars. They have length 2. And if you have a space which has length 17, how many different places can you park your car if it's got discrete little holes or little cups where you can put the front of the car? So if you have a space of size 17, there are 16 places where you can put the front bumper of the car such that it fills the hole. So here, let me maybe do it with not 17 because that takes too long to draw, but say length 5. So if I have an interval of length 5, so this is of size 5, my car could be here and here. So it could be here, 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 or here. 4 places. So there's m minus 1 ways in which I can park in a parking spot of size m, and I will then decrease the number of intervals of size m. On the other hand, there's one other way that I can decrease an interval of size m. It could be that here is my m interval, but again, we don't have any idea what was happening on either side of this interval. We don't care. But it could be that this site was also empty, and I could have parked my car here, in which case I would have decreased the number of intervals of size m. But in order to park the car with one part of the car inside the parking spot and one part outside, I also need this site has to be empty. So if I have an interval of size m plus 1, I could then park at the edge of the interval, and I could either park at the right edge or the left edge. So there's two ways in which this I can accomplish this, and this will contribute to the decrease in the number of intervals of size m. So here is the master equation that describes the evolution of this empty interval probability. Yes?
How's your t scale here?
Well,
is it like every time step something is absorbed?
Yeah, so you know, I've been cavalier about how I'm defining the time here because you know, I could say that every time step one particle comes in or 17 particles comes in, but whatever I choose as my rate, I can always reabsorb it into the time. So in the way I've written it this way, I'm assuming that there's one adsorption event per unit time, per unit length of the system. Okay. So now we want to solve this differential equation. And so how do we solve it? Well, one thing you may notice right away is that if I forget about this term, this is a very simple equation to solve because it's exponential solution. E sub m is e to the minus m minus 1 t. And again, this is one of those things that you'd probably had in a sophomore differential equations course and would forget it, which is that if I now put in this term, the solution to this equation is the solution to the homogeneous equation times some other function of time. So let me try. Let's try a solution, which is E sub m, which is equal to E to the minus m minus 1 t, which is the homogeneous solution, times some other function phi of t. So let's just plug it in and see what happens. So if I plug it in, on the left-hand side, when I differentiate, there are two terms. One where I differentiate the exponential, and so I'm going to get minus m minus 1 e to the minus m minus 1 t phi. And then another term where I differentiate the phi, so I'm going to get plus e to the minus m minus 1 t phi dot. And on the right-hand side, I'm going to get minus m minus 1 times em, which is e to the minus m minus 1 t phi. And then I'll have minus 2, and so e to the m plus 1. So I have e to the minus m t times phi. And so those terms cancel. And then I have a very simple equation for phi dot. Phi dot is equal. So I cancel out the factor e to the minus m minus 1 t, and I'm going to get equal to minus 2 e to the minus t phi. So another thing to emphasize about what I've done here is that the original problem was translationally invariant. I'm thinking about an infinitely large one-dimensional line. I have an equation of motion for the evolution of empty interval probabilities, but it clearly is translationally invariant. And by this trick, I transform an infinite set of equations for each of the e sub m's into a single differential equation for this auxiliary function phi. And in solid state physics and any problem which involves translational invariance, this kind of a trick of writing things as something which is, you know, takes away the space dependence and you're left with just the time dependence appears in many contexts. So this equation we can solve. By the way, in order to solve this, we need an initial condition. So let me now, you know, let me add an initial condition here. Let's suppose that at t equals 0, the system is empty. And if the system is empty, that means that em of t of 0 at t equals 0, well, if the system is empty, that means that probability of having an empty interval of any length is just equal to 1.
So there you've switched again to the, sorry, we're staying with the infinite case. Then for.
Well, I'm sorry, what do you mean infinite case?
We had been talking about
small systems previously. This master equation is appropriate for an infinite size system because I'm allowing m to be anything. You know, m here can be anywhere from 1 to infinity. So this is appropriate for an infinite one-dimensional line. Anyways, if e sub m of 0 is equal to 1, that also translates to phi at t equals 0 is also equal to 1. So now I can solve this differential equation. And what I'm going to get, so I'm going to get phi dot over phi, the integral of that, is equal to the integral of minus 2 e to the minus t, the integral from 0 up to t. And if you do this integration, what one gets out of all of this is phi of t, the log phi of t, because that's what I'm integrating here, is equal to minus 2, 1 minus 1 minus e to the minus t. I'm going to go through your chalk budget in one lecture here. They can afford the chalk? Okay. Okay, and so phi of t is equal to exp minus 2, 1 minus e to the minus t. And so finally, let me, let's maybe put it over here. So I have then that e sub m of t. So that's equal to e to the minus m minus 1 t times phi, which is minus 2, 1 minus e to the minus t. So one thing to notice about this, and just in terms of aesthetics, is the fact that a lot of the quantities that appear in these irreversible adsorption problems have this double exponential form. There's exponential of time. So they're really kind of funky functions. And now we're almost done, because what we wanted to calculate was the coverage of the system. How can we relate the coverage of the system to these empty interval probabilities? So let's focus attention for the moment on E1. So this is the probability that I have a blinder that sees only a single sight, and I look through my blinder that sees only a single sight, and this is the probability that a single site is empty. So E1 is e to the minus 2, 1 minus e to the minus t. So this is equal to the probability that one site is empty. So 1 minus this quantity is the probability that that site is occupied, which is the density. So the density, rho, is equal to 1 minus E1. And this is therefore just 1 minus e to the minus 2, 1 minus e to the minus t. So that is my main result that comes from the story of the evolution of the coverage of the system as a function of time. And now we're in a position to take the limit as t goes to infinity and then something miraculous happens in the limit t going to infinity. This just goes away, and we get 1 minus e to the minus 2. So here is the famous Fourier result. And you see that I didn't work very hard to get this result. Once I had the right frame of reference, it follows in a very natural way. Another thing to emphasize about this is that in addition to finding the coverage, I have much more information about the system. I have the full time-dependent behavior of these empty interval probabilities. So I have essentially a complete characterization of the state of the system at all times. And then as a byproduct, I calculate the final coverage of the system. So that is the problem of dimer adsorption. Yeah, well, I'm just saying that here we have the probability of finding an empty interval of size m. And now I want to say, let's, for fun, just look at the density of empty intervals of size 1. So E1 is the probability when I look through my blinders, which has width 1 here, that what I see inside is an empty site. So I'm just counting here the probability that a single site is empty. The density is when I look with my blinders and say, what's the probability that the site is occupied? So the reason of focusing on the single site empty interval probability is that its complement is just the occupation, is the density, which is kind of the basic observable that you'd want to calculate. Yes?
The number, was it for, is that related to n equals to 1? N equals to 1, then the number that you want to write initially?
Or? This one here. This, right. Yeah, so the thing is, again, here we have em for nem. Here was e sub 1. And I take 1 minus e sub 1, and the limit as t goes to infinity, it exactly reduces to the final coverage because this was the density as a function of time. Have I asked your question? I'm not sure.
I think I'm trying to wonder. I don't see how the dimer is related to the n equals to 1.
Well, the thing is that these e sub m's are, I can do this for any value of m. These are empty interval probabilities. There's the size of the thing which is being adsorbed is like something which is a fixed parameter that I just say I'm adsorbing dimers. And then I can ask, in this dimer adsorption problem, what's the probability that a region of size 14 happens to be empty of all dimers? So we could also, if you want to be a masochist, we could study the problem of depositing cars of length 5 on an infinite lattice. And we could write down the same rate equations. I think that might even, this might be in the notes. And one can solve the problem for arbitrary k-mer adsorption rather than just dimer adsorption. Any other questions? No, this is all in the infinite system size limit because this equation goes from, you know, this equation is true for any m greater than or equal to 1. So in particular, I need a structure where m is going from 1 to infinity where I have translational invariant, well, you know, I have sort of uniform behavior as a function of m, and this allowed me to do this product form. And then I, so we needed to have m be unrestricted here to do this trick. Okay, so that is the story of dimer adsorption. But now the thing is that, as we all know, we don't drive discrete cars that fill up discrete parking spaces. And if any of you have lived in a student ghetto, say in Boston, you know, there's tons of students, and there's these areas called the student ghettos. And in these student ghettos, there are not parking meters, there is parking permits. If you buy a parking permit, you're allowed to park anywhere where you want to park in these permit streets. Not anywhere, but, you know, in the permitted parts of the curb. So what that means, think about it, what does it look like? What does parking look like in the student ghettos one day after classes start? Every single parking spot is completely jammed. And as soon as a car leaves a parking spot, another car comes in almost immediately. So let's now study the problem of irreversible car parking rather than just dimer parking, which is not a terribly interesting thing if you want to figure out, are you going to be able to park your car? So let's now talk about car adsorption, not dimer adsorption. And what I again want to show is that with the same calculational tools, we can understand the problem of car adsorption in 1D. And it turns out that the infinite time coverage for irreversible So let me emphasize here, irreversible. So here, what I mean by irreversible car absorption is you come to school on September 2nd, you park your car, and you never use it until you graduate 4 years later, and then you leave. So you just park your car, and you just leave it there forever, and you want to ask, like, what is the final coverage of the system? And it turns out that this final coverage of the system was derived in 1950 by a guy, a Hungarian mathematician named Albert Reinyi, and again, a very hairy calculation that I could never imagine reproducing. But he came up with a number. It was something like 0.7. Does somebody have my notes handy? I forgot the number. It's 747 or 757. I think it's 747 dot, dot, dot. And what I want to show now is how you derive this number, again, using the tools of non-equilibrium statistical physics. So again, proceeding almost in the same way from a intellectual perspective, instead of looking at intervals of size m, which are discrete, we really have to focus now on the possibility of intervals of continuous size. So let me now call E of x is equal to the probability of finding an empty interval of length greater than or equal to x. So it's the perfect analog of the E sub m in the discrete case. Now I just want to ask, do I find a parking space? I don't care if I find a parking space if it is 10 times the size of my car or 1.01 times the size of my car. If I can just fit my car in it, I park it, I abandon it, and I'm happy. So all I care about is that the interval is at least as big as the size of my car. And again, let's simplify the problem in a way a physicist might do it, which is we're going to assume that all our cars are the same size, say of unit length, and that when you park a car, it's not like you park and you do whatever is called the back-in parking and what you learn in driving school. I'm going to assume that if there is a parking spot, so here's my one-dimensional line, and here's a car parked, and here's a car parked, here's me in my car. And if the size here is infinitesimally bigger, I can just sort of park, I can sort of turn my wheels sideways and just park straight in without any funny business. So this is the parking process that I want to calculate. So I want to now write down, in the same spirit as what I wrote over here and partially erased, a dynamical equation that describes how the empty interval probabilities evolve with time. So I want to write down an equation dE sub x by dt. How does this change with time? And in the same way as in the case of the empty interval probabilities for discrete dimer deposition, this thing can only decrease. And so how does this decrease? So equals. And here it turns out we have to be somewhat more careful in calculating these empty interval probabilities, and I'll show all these details as I go along. So it's a little bit unfortunate that I erased this. Let me maybe put this back here again. So I had dE sub m by dt was equal to minus m minus 1 e sub m. So this was the equation we started with. I'm going to write down almost the same thing. So how can I park in a interval of size x? First point is that I need to have the interval is bigger than 1 in order that I can park at all inside of that interval. If I have an interval which is a size x larger than 1, then how many ways can I park? X minus 1 ways. So let's just draw a little cartoon to illustrate this. So here's the curb. Here's a car. Here's another car. Here is a region of size x, which is larger than 1. And my cars are all of size 1. So I could park right there. And I could park, and what's left over here is x minus 1. But I could park anywhere here in any one of this x minus 1 space, and that would be a good parking job. So the probability of parking in a region of size x will be equal to x minus 1 times ex. So that's the first term. And then there's an analog of this term where I park in a space which is, so let me maybe draw now a cartoon for this guy. which is that if I have a space which is of size x, it could be that I park my car, try and draw something that looks a little bit more like a car, I park my car over here. And in so doing, I lose an interval of size x. And just the same way here, in order to park in an interval which part of it is inside and part of it is outside, I actually need an interval which is of larger size that it incorporates the initial parking space plus the additional car. So the analog of this is now minus twice, and let me move this x greater than 1 a little bit off to the right, so x greater than 1. I'll have an integral that goes from, it goes from x to x plus 1 ey dy. And that's the analog of what I had over here. In this particular case, in order to park a car and have part of the car in the interval of size x, the interval can be anywhere from, the nose of the car can be anywhere just at the edge to almost all the way inside, and that would correspond to filling up an interval which was larger than the original parking spot and impinging on the original parking spot. And so that is the equation that describes the evolution of intervals of size x larger than 1. And you see that there's a one-to-one correspondence between this state, you know, this equation and this equation. Now, there's actually one more aspect to this which is missing in the discrete case, is that it is also possible to kill a parking space of size less than 1. Because the crucial point here is that I'm looking at the empty interval of length greater than or equal to x. So if x is less than 1, if I have a parking spot which is a size x, which is less than 1, because we're not paying attention to what's happening outside, it actually could be part of a much larger empty interval. And here's a car over here, for example. Here is a car over here. And then it's possible that we park somewhere and remove some of these intervals of small size. So there's a second equation that applies for x less than 1. And so let's see what happens here. So I would write this as minus 1 minus x, e1. That's one term. Because, for example, if I had an interval which is exactly of size, sorry, this is ex. So if I had an interval here which is of size x, which is less than 1, but on the outside it was empty. No, I'm sorry, I need e1. I'll get it right. E1. So the point is that here is my car, which is bigger than the spot, but it can fill up the space of length less than 1 if the head of the car is over here, and I can move. So let me look at the extreme cases here. Here was my interval of size 1, of size x, for example, and here's my car of size 1. I could have parked my car over here, or I could have parked my car over here, or anything in between, and that would fill up this parking spot. And so the number of ways of doing it is exactly 1 minus x. And then similarly, there is minus 2, because again, I could park my car such that it doesn't completely fill up the space, but just fills up part of the space. And so I'm going to have an interval that goes from x to x plus 1, it goes from 1 to x plus 1, e of y dy. Because I need at least an interval of size 1 to accommodate the car. And then the interval can be up to size x plus 1. And that would then count the number of different ways in which a car could park such that part of the car impinged on the parking space of size x. So the point here is that these equations have a direct analog with what we saw in dimer adsorption. And one can draw a little cartoon to explain each of the terms that appears in this master equation. Now, I think I'm not going to spend much more in the problem of solving this equation. But let me just give you a hint about how you would go about solving it, because it's exactly the same as what we do for dimer adsorption, which is, let's focus on this equation. We have dE by dt is minus x minus 1 ex. looks exactly the same as this, plus some other stuff. And so the homogeneous equation is simple to solve. It's just exponential decay. Yes?
More intuitive to see how the form these equations have to have if you look at, say, the trimer case or a larger polymer, because like if you do the polymer case, do you end up with a sum for that?
Absolutely.
Term?
That's right. This would be, okay. if instead of absorbing, you know, continuous cars, I had to absorb 5 mers, then there would be a sum over 4 different waves of the endpoint or the end configuration occurring. And so, yes, you could do it that way and then take the limit as the size of the thing that you're absorbing went to infinity, and then you would end up with these equations. So whichever way works better for you is fine. Anyways, I just want to very briefly give you a sense of the solution, which is if you make the same attempt, let's try EXT is equal to e to the minus x minus 1 t times, again, this function phi. But what is this function phi? We see that when I have here x equals 1, this thing is 1. And so the thing which is left over is exactly e1t. So if we make this assumption and plug it in, you will find like the same steps that I just spent some time discussing in the case of dimer adsorption. Every single step follows through line by line. And one finds at the end of the day a very not so simple formula for the empty interval probability. And so let me just write down. I'm just going to write down the answer at this stage. EXT is equal to exponential of minus integral 2 over t prime 1 minus e to the minus t prime dt prime, integral from 0 up to t. And you see that it has a similar form to the e sub m, which we had over here. It looks somewhat similar. And then the last part of all of this is that we then have to calculate the coverage. And in fact, the coverage comes from this equation because we can focus attention to what happens to this equation when x is equal to 1. So for x equals 1, I have the dE, well, actually, let's do x equals 0. Let's do dE 0 by dt. Oh, I'm sorry. This is e. Yeah, so this is e1t, and so ext would be e1t times this thing here. Anyways, the thing is that to find the final density, we again look at an endpoint equation. And so for x equals 0 here, we're going to have minus e1.
That gives us the coverage?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes. So and this term, if x equals 0, there's no integral to do here. And so again, what does E0 mean? So we're thinking about having an infinitesimal size region, which is going to 0, and putting my blinders on and saying, in that infinitesimal size region, is it empty or occupied? And so we're asking for the density of infinitesimal regions that are empty. And the density, 1, rho, is equal just to 1 minus E of 0. So the thing is that we have E of 1. We can then find E of 0 by integrating E of 1, and we take 1 minus that to get the final coverage of the lattice. And so here is a formula for the final coverage of the lattice. And unfortunately, it looks rather ugly because it's going to be the integral of a function which is e to the e to the something. And so in fact, I'm not going to write it down anymore because it just gets a little bit hairy. But the final result is that I plug in t going to infinity here, you find this Regnier constant. So the problem of dimer adsorption, I think, is very simple. The problem of car adsorption gets a little bit more mathematically complex. But I hope I've given you a little bit of a sense of what happens in that case. Now, what I'd like to spend the last 15 minutes or so discussing is something which is a little bit more realistic than irreversible car adsorption, Because again, this is the problem where you parked your car, you left it forever, the system went to a final coverage of 3/4, roughly speaking. But what do we do when we're students and we have our cars? We go out to parties, we go someplace, we come back at night, we're then circling the block many times looking for a parking spot and cursing, but eventually we'll find a place to park. And what happens in the case of reversible car adsorption is actually much richer, but also can be understood in a much simpler fashion by just very intuitive approaches. So in the remaining time, I want to talk about reversible car adsorption. So let's do reversible car adsorption. And so let's again start as simple as possible. And let's look at a simpler case. So here's as a preliminary. Let's do reversible monomer adsorption. So in reversible monomer adsorption, again, I have my one-dimensional lattice, and it has a bunch of adsorption sites. And so somebody can come in, and let's call the adsorption rate R sub plus now. Now there's two different rates, because I adsorb with one rate, I'll desorb with a different rate. And so if I'm already here, let's desorb with the rate R minus. So I'm putting in the rates explicitly now, just because since there's more than one rate, I have to keep track of the relative magnitudes. And now we can write down a rate equation for how the density changes with time. So how does the density change? Well, I increase the density if I land on a vacant site. The density of vacant sites is 1 minus rho. This is the rate at which I'm going to adsorb on a vacant site. So this will contribute to the increase in the density. But then with the rate R sub minus, I desorb at any occupied site, and I lose occupied sites. And so here is how the density changes. I either gain with a rate proportional to the vacancy density, or I lose proportional to the density of stuff which is already there. And so this equation is a trivial one to solve. And so let me just write down the answer. Rho of t is equal to rho infinity plus rho 0 minus rho infinity e to the minus t over tau. And so you see that at t equals 0, the density is just the initial density. So rho 0 here refers to the initial density. As t goes to infinity, we go to the final density. So that's what I call rho infinity. Where in this formula, this time constant is equal to r plus r minus inverse. And the final coverage, rho infinity, is equal to r plus divided by r plus r minus. So notice that as r plus goes to infinity, the adsorption rate getting very large compared to the desorption rate, the coverage gradually approaches 1. So in this problem of parking like at single sites and desorbing at single sites, if I park infinitely quickly, so as soon as a parking space comes available, there's a horde of cars trying to all take that one spot, then the final density of the system is going to approach 1. So this is the problem of good old monomer adsorption. And what I want to do now is let's talk about the case of real cars. So now let's talk about reversible car adsorption. And in this particular case, I think that you have a very good intuition for what's going to happen in reversible car adsorption. So again, unless you were like living in the wilds of New Zealand with no cars or anything like that, I hope you've all experienced this feature that, you know, if you go to a place that's very heavily parked up, you know, you're cursing because there's a spot that's like 7/8 of the size of a car, and in front of it is like a Lincoln Continental that if it only had pulled up a couple of inches, you could have parked there, and you're cursing. Why couldn't I have parked there? And so that picture is how we're going to understand what happens in reversible car adsorption. And the thing which is amazing about reversible car adsorption is that we already saw that it was irreversible car adsorption, the coverage went to about 3/4. If I have an infinitesimal amount of adsorption, the final coverage goes to 1. And so there is a discontinuous change in the density when I continuously change a parameter. This feature of discontinuous change when I continuously change a parameter is like what makes these sorts of problems so cool, because you would think that when I change a parameter continuously, something should often change continuously. Anyways, let's now talk about reversible car adsorption. So what I want to do is I want to write down the analog of a rate equation for cars. So let's try and do it just on the basis of the simplest possible line of reasoning. So think about the problem of cars like in Boston, the student ghetto is called Alston Brighton. So I'm going to use the terms there. In Alston Brighton, if I look at the curb, you'll see that there's a car like this. There's another car like that. There might be a tiny little space here, another little space here, something like this. And then there's somebody like right up against the other guy. And so when he tries to get out, like it sets off the car alarm. So this is pretty well parked up. And so what happens if somebody leaves a space? The point is that there is like, because there's not enough parking spaces, everywhere you look, there are people circling the block trying to find parking spots. So as soon as somebody comes out, if this guy leaves, then instantly it is refilled. You wait zero time and it's refilled. So most of the time, the density of this Alston Brighton doesn't change. All you're doing is that when a car leaves this parking spot, it just might move a little bit. So that's point number one, is that most events, so one car changes position slightly. And that's it. So because each car is changing position slightly and almost all events involve this, what you can think about happening here is that the cars are just diffusing inside of their cages mandated by their nearest neighbors. And because the cars are diffusing inside of their cages, this is basically an equilibrium picture. And in an equilibrium picture, there is a distance between neighboring cars. Let's call this distance x. And the probability distribution of x would just be given by a Poisson distribution, just an exponential distribution. But in fact, we don't even need any of this thing. Let's just look at the average value of x. And it turns out that this average value of x controls how the evolution, how the coverage ever evolves. Because how is it possible that the density could ever increase here? I just said that when a parking space became available, then it was refilled immediately. The way an additional parking space can become available is that you have some cooperative behavior going on. Like imagine that instead of people leaving their cars and going away to do whatever they want to do, that everybody's just waiting by their car. And you come in, and suppose there was a space that looked like this. Let's make it a little bit smaller. So here's a space, and here's my car, which doesn't fit. But I say, hey, could you just move ahead by 2 inches? And you move ahead by 3 inches, and you move ahead by 4 inches, you move ahead by 5 inches, and then I have enough space to park. So if I can generate this cooperative behavior, then I can increase the density. So the point is that most events are just the cars are diffusing in their cages, but every once in a while, you can't imagine in Boston asking people cooperatively, could you please move, and everybody moves nicely. But by good luck, just by random events, it could be that when this car left, the new car that went in was a little bit in front. And then when this car left, the next car moved a little bit further up. And you, by just random events, you could get this cooperativity to occur. And it turns out this cooperativity is what's going to give rise to a very beautiful equation for the evolution of the density. OK, but rare events, rare cooperative events. Cooperative events. One more car can park. So what I want to do now is turn this vague physical argument into some mathematics that we can then solve. So first point is that, notice, what is the density? The density rho, in this situation where there's an average spacing between cars, which is x. So what it means is that the density is, I have one car per parking space. And how much space does a car occupy? It occupies itself plus a distance with its neighbor. So the density is one car per parking space. And the parking space has length 1 plus x average, where x is the distance between adjacent cars. So in particular, x average is equal to, so I have 1 plus x is 1 over rho, so this is equal to 1 over rho minus 1, which I can write as 1 minus rho over rho. So the point is that if I want to make another car being able to park, here is the spacing between cars, and my cars of length 1. So if n cars, so n equals 1 over x average cars, move cooperatively, then one more car can park. So for example, if x average is 1/10, then if I have 10 cars, each of which moves forward by 1/10, I'll have generated a new parking space. So what I'd like to argue then is that this master equation for car parking, well, there's never any desorption because it's always filled immediately. But in the adsorption events, most adsorption events don't increase the coverage because a car desorbs and then immediately it reabsorbs, and so this term doesn't give rise to an increase of the coverage, and this term doesn't give rise to any decrease because they occur essentially simultaneously. As soon as there's adsorption, there's reabsorption, and that's the end of the day. But for these cooperative events, what I'd like to argue is the following. So d rho by dt, and so this is now, let me write this with a squiggle to denote that it's not really a mathematical equation that I'm proving, but this is now a physical argument that incorporates the main processes that occur in this cooperative car parking. So first of all, in order for a car to park, an additional car to park, I must have a vacancy. And then with a rate r plus, a car comes in and tries to park. But the thing is that I want to have, in order for, so the way I've written this term here is that because this is with a plus sign, this means we increase the density. The only way we can increase the density is that in addition to allowing for adsorption of a car, n other cars had to move cooperatively to generate the additional parking spot. What is the probability that n cars will do this cooperative motion? Each one of these things occurs with some probability, whatever it is, that the car actually moved forward by the right amount. And I have n of these cars that each have to do the same thing. And so I would say the probability of this is proportional to e to the minus a constant times n. So let me forget about the constant here, because the crucial thing is just the n. And so this is 1 minus rho r plus e to the minus 1 minus rho over rho. So here is an equation for rho as a function of time. And notice that as rho goes to 1, this goes to 0. And so the rate at which cars park, or the rate at which the density increases, increases very slowly with time as the density gets, as the system gets full. Whoops, I've done something exactly backwards. Exactly backwards. N is 1 over x. So this is rho. Yeah, this is much better. Rho over 1 minus rho. Notice, this is the point that was really lost in the previous one, is that as rho goes to 1, this is e to the minus infinity. This is going to 0 incredibly rapidly. This is what's called an essential singularity. When I have e to the minus 1 over a quantity, and as that quantity goes to 0, that e to the minus 1 over 0 is very rapidly e to the minus infinity. And so this is an incredibly small increase in the density. And so now let's ask how the density increases as a function of time. Now, the thing is that this equation, as written, does not have a solution. But if we want to assume that the density is approaching 1, we can do a simple perturbation approach to estimate how the density approaches 1. And so this will be my punchline, and it's going to just take a second to do it. So I want to ask, as t goes to infinity, what is the behavior of rho? And to calculate this, let me make the following observation. Let me write g. Let me define g as equal to 1 over 1 minus rho. Let me just do that for fun. And so in particular, then, rho, so rho is equal to 1 minus 1 over g. And so rho dot is equal to g dot over g squared. And so this equation becomes now, so rho dot is g dot over g squared is equal to r plus, and 1 minus rho is 1 over g. And then I have e to the minus. Well, 1 over rho is g. And rho is 1 minus 1 over g. But the thing is that when rho is close to 1, if rho is close to 1, let's just replace this by 1. And so I get finally that g dot is equal to r plus g e to the minus g. This equation still doesn't have a solution, but we're almost there, because the thing is that I can write this as r plus e to the minus g plus log g. Notice that as rho goes to 1, g is getting huge. And so when g is huge, log g can forget about with respect to g. So I'll just forget about this guy. And so when g is huge, then the rate at which g changes is very small. And in this equation, the solution to this is just g is proportional to logarithm of t. And you see that if I take g dot, I get 1 over t, and e to the minus g is 1 over t. So this is the asymptotic solution to this equation. And finally, I get that rho is equal to 1 minus 1 over log t. So that is the punchline of this part of the story, that the rate at which the density increases is incredibly slow. In order to fill up your parking lot, you need to have all these cooperative events occur. They take a very long time to occur. And so you get this inverse logarithmic law for the increase in the density. Now, part of the reason that I wanted to show this final result is that there is a whole field of physics which has become very popular in the past 20 years called granular materials. You know, you may know, like when you were in high school, you learned there are three states of matter, solid, liquid, and gas. And maybe you learned about plasmas, which might have been the fourth state of matter. That's what I learned in the 1960s and 50s when I was in elementary school. But it turns out that granular media, sand, is another state of matter, which is not a solid and it's not a liquid. If you take sand, you think, well, is it solid or liquid? You can pour it, so you say, well, it's a liquid. But on the other hand, you can step on it and it supports your weight, so it's a solid. So which is it? And it's not clear really what it is. And because of this feature that it's not really a solid, it's not really liquid, it has unusual properties. And one of the most unusual properties is that if you take a cup of sand and just shake it, it will gradually compactify. And in fact, when my children were little, my son, who's actually very smart, he understood granular compaction in a very nice way, because I would say, you may have after dinner half a cup of M&Ms and no more. And so what my son would do is he'd fill up the cup half and half, and he'd shake and shake and shake, and it would go down to a little bit less than half. Daddy, I need some more M&Ms. And so I'd give him some more M&Ms, and you know, he learned the trick very well. So the point is that you take any kind of a granular system, and as you compactify it, the density gradually increases. But what's amazing about this is that if you take good old beach sand and put it in a large container and shake it, you'll see that the density is gradually increasing. But you keep shaking it 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month, it's still gradually getting more and more compact. And in fact, people who've done experiments with compaction of sand have found this inverse logarithmic law of the approach of the density to the final density. So this inverse logarithmic law, which is not very easy to derive by any first principles calculation, at least by this car parking analogy, one gets a sense like where it possibly can come from that involves some long-range cooperativity, because you need to have lots of other sand grains get out of the way to allow another sand grain to move a little bit further down to compactify the system. So this is a whirlwind tour through adsorption kinetics. And I think I'm going to stop here. And let me just give you a prelude for next week, because next week, as I said, I'm going to be talking about many different areas of non-equilibrium statistical physics. I'll turn to talking about the non-equilibrium Ising model. And so I'm assuming, and tell me if I'm incorrect, that you've had from Professor Kadanoff at least some introduction to the equilibrium Ising model. People feel comfortable with the Ising model, at least what it is. So I'm going to spend some time describing the equilibrium Ising model, also a little bit of time on chemical reaction kinetics and the kinetics of and the structure of complex networks. So that'll be for next week. I'm done.